Good evening. That can you hear me okay? Well, I'm going to talk tonight about. About my experience at the recent 3-week intensive at Green Gulch Farm. And I thought I would appear before you in the way that I appeared there in these troublesome robes. Suzuki Roshi actually called them that, these troublesome robes. So one of the intensive is something I've done. This was the sixth time I've done the 3-week intensive at Green Gulch Farm. And I found that it doesn't get any easier. You know what to expect. You think you know what to expect. And you find out that each time it's like climbing a new mountain. And it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. Each step can be like, when you're climbing a mountain, like each step you have to put effort into. And it's sort of like that with the intensive. Each period of zazen you have to put effort into. Each meal you have to put effort into. And it calls forth something from you. And because it does, it has a wonderful resonance in your body-mind. But it is hard. And I set a couple of extra degrees of difficulty for this one for myself, because it was the first time that I had practiced in the monastic setting, day after day, in these robes, in this outer robe, and one thing about, and the robe that's beneath it, and there's a robe beneath that, and actually there's one beneath that. You know, you're constantly changing clothes. You're constantly getting in and out of the robe. So this is good practice for a priest, maybe because you need to learn how to negotiate your robes. But it was, whereas I have worn these robes a number of times, I've never been in a practice period where I do it over and over and over again, constantly getting in and out. And that led to some memorable misadventures. One of the things, because I had put them on always in a room with some light, but in the Zendo it's dark, and so you have, especially in the morning. So in the morning, they do the robe chant before they turn up the lights, and then at the end of the robe chant, you put on this outer robe. The rest of the robes you have on, but the outer robe, this is called the Okesa. You don't put that on until the robe chant is done. Well, the robe is all black, and it's dark, and the robe ties are black. So it's very difficult to see where the robe is and where the robe ties are. And at one point, so my solution, I had a strategy, and my strategy early on in the intensive was, before the robe chant ends, I will start putting my robe on. And that way, I'll be ready. However, after about the fifth day, the person who was leading the intensive had noticed that I was putting my robe on before the robe chant ended, and he asked me not to do that, but to wait until the robe chant ended. I said, well, I was trying to get ahead. This fell on unsympathetic ears. So I acceded to the request. And then Well, before I acceded to the request, the person who was leading the retreat brought up the issue of my starting to put the robe on before the end of the chant in the Sunday lecture before hundreds of people. Now, they didn't all know that. I think they did, actually, because, you see, I was he referred to me as his attendant. And, in fact, I was his attendant for this three-week intensive, which I was very honored to be able to a role that I had never played before, thereby setting another degree of difficulty for myself. But still honored to be asked to do it and happy to be able to do it with him. Well, this is a teacher that I have known for. Reb Anderson, I have known for more than 30 years, maybe 40 years, I guess, by now. So we've known each other a long time. But I've never had the opportunity to... I've played other roles with him. I played him as abbot and me as head student once. That was about 15 years ago. But I'd never been his attendant. So that was an extra degree of difficulty because I had to get up earlier than everyone else to do all the things that were necessary to do to attend to him and to do the things that need to be done before the first period of Zazen. So I had to get up at 4:10 every day and for to be ready for 5:00 Zazen. So there was a lot to do. I had to, of course, get on all my stuff. Not the outer robe. You wait and get that on, but all of this, and then take this to the zendo, put the robe, this robe where I thought I was going to be when the robe chant was chanted, and I often didn't know because I was following the teacher around, and I didn't know exactly where he would be. Would he be in the zendo? Would he be out of the zendo? If my robe was in the zendo when he was out of the zendo and I had to be with him, then I wouldn't be with my robe. I wouldn't have a robe to do the robe chant with. So I had to, and I was given very little instruction or guidance by him. I mean, I could ask some other people around who had been his jisha. That's what it's called. The attendant's called the jisha. So I could ask a few questions, but they couldn't tell me where my robe needed to be at any given time. I had to figure that out. And finally I figured out, I just need to keep it close. Whatever. I just need to make sure it's close. So I need to keep it close to me. And that seemed to work as a general guideline. But anyway, I had to get up early. And each time there was a new time to open the zendo with the teacher, I had to go to his house, greet him, and then follow him to the zendo and shine a flashlight for him and, take him to the zendo. And then in the morning, we would go around and light incense at 5 different altars. So I would carry 5 sticks of incense and we'd go to these various altars, which I had lit in advance. That was one of the things I was doing before, things had started. And there were some memorable lapses on my part. For instance, sometimes you didn't have to go around and light 4 or 5 altars. You only had to light 1, which was in the zendo. So sometimes it was in the morning. You always had to do 5 in the afternoon and evening. You only had to do 1 stick of incense. Well, one morning, I don't know, I just got 1 stick of incense. And we got up to the first altar. I think he just set me up for this. We got up to the first altar, and I was supposed to have 5 sticks of incense, and I had 1 stick of incense. And he said, "I wondered what you were going to do." So this has probably happened before, So he sent me down anyway. He went to some other altars without any incense while I went down and lit 2 more sticks, and, I survived that. But anyway, it seemed to me that I had to make every mistake that could be made at least once And then once I had made that mistake, I wouldn't make it again. Like I was supposed to blow out all the candles after we went to the altar, but then I'd forget to blow out the candles. But after I forgot to blow out the candles, then I would remember to blow out the candles. But it's still, I'd have to forget first. And this happened, you know, repeatedly during the beginning part of the intensive. And the other thing is, well, I'll tell you the one other funny story is, okay, so one morning I'm going to pick him up, and I have this, and you carry, this is called the zagu, or the bowing cloth, and you put it down, you open it up and put it down whenever you're going to bow in this okesa, because it's meant to be a cloth that protects the okesa. That's its function. You wear this cloth just like this on your wrist, just draped over your wrist. There's nothing holding it on. Now you can, if you're smart, which I learned to be, you can, when you're walking around in you know, the field, you can keep a little finger on it so that, you know, you secure it. But once you're in the zendo and stuff, you can't do that. And if you're carrying incense and so forth, you can't do that because you're carrying incense like this with two hands. But anyway, one morning, or maybe it was an evening. I think it was an evening. It was night. I was going to get him for night zazen. It had been raining, and I was a little late. And so I decided, well, I can get the okesa sort of on, and then I'll adjust it as I'm walking. So I'm adjusting the okesa, and I'm getting it fixed up and blah, 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 blah. And I come along the road, and all of a sudden I realize this is not there anymore. And I've obviously dropped it somewhere behind me. It's dark. It's been raining. Not quite recently. It wasn't raining right then, thank goodness. So I'm running back along with my flashlight. You can envision me with my flashlight going backwards. I'm supposed to be going forwards. I'm supposed to be getting him. I'm already late. And I'm running back there, and I'm praying that this has fallen in a dry place. Just pray. Please be in a dry place. And it was. It was way back, too, though, way back. So I was quite late. But it was in a dry place. So, you know, like I say, if I could have a misadventure with any of this stuff, it seemed like I would have at least one, and then I would learn what the consequences of that misadventure was, and I would somehow I got better at some of these things. And Doralee came to Zacheen, and she saw me, and I don't remember that I made any mistakes when she saw me. So I was getting pretty professional by the time the end of the event came along. But you know, if there was a mistake to be made, I seemed to at first make it. But one of the things that I really noticed was that some years ago, let's say, in my practice, if I had made these kind of mistakes in front of the assembly and in front of my teacher, I would have been really quite chagrined, you know, and really, really mortified and would have had a strong tendency to just feel terrible and potentially say nasty things to myself and you know, beat myself up, essentially. And one thing I noticed was that even despite these mistakes, it didn't really seem to, you know, linger. I made the mistakes, and you know, I felt bad at the time that I made the mistake, but I didn't carry it. And you know, that was really encouraging. It was really encouraging that I wasn't carrying, you know, the things that I was doing wrong with me. And I thought, well, that's it's great, you know. I'm happy. I was really happy about that. I was really happy to have that kind of attitude that seemed to just come with the job, or, you know, seemed to be there. So, and maybe that's enough about my personal experience. The main point, I think, of the January intensive is to sit a lot of zazen. We sit many periods a day for 3 weeks. I think the average number of periods on the regular schedule is 7 or 8 periods a day. And then we go to the sesshin at the end for 5 days. We sit 10 periods each day during sesshin. And even on the day off, you sit 3 periods. So there's a lot of opportunity to go back to your cushion. There's a lot of opportunity to settle into your zazen in a more deliberate and perhaps thorough way than we're usually able to do. And when you have that kind of opportunity and that amount of sitting meditation, one of the functions of that kind of practice is to appears to be to reveal clearly to you your unconscious life, to see clearly what's going on beneath the surface. When, you know, usually we stay on the surface of our minds in thoughts and feelings. That's where we reside. We live our life in on the surface of our minds. And when we go into this kind of work, this kind of meditation work, we go beneath the surface of the mind, and it's quite shocking, I think, for most people to find what is there beneath the surface. It's quite shocking, and it's also quite revealing, and it can be quite sublime. So there are various things down there in the depths. You know, it's kind of like you know, you put a spade in the earth, right? And you know, we're interested in what grows on the surface of the earth, but in order to make things grow, we have to turn the earth. We have to dig a spade down deep and turn it, and bring up what's beneath. We have to bring up, you know, we don't know what we're going to find down there, but we have to turn it in order to get things to grow. So it's kind of a homely analogy, but it is really kind of what I think is happening in sitting meditation. That's revisited, when sitting meditation is revisited over and over and over again, your perspective quite changes. What I did was I do a little bit of writing during the intensive, not too much. It's just like that when things come along and sort of hit me over the head that I feel like I really need to take a note here. Yeah.
I don't want this to get away from you before you keep going.
Okay.
So you mentioned sublime.
Mm-hmm.
You need the surface. And then you also mentioned digging it up.
Mm-hmm.
Please speak more about the sublime and how does this digging up look like?
Well, bear with me.
Okay.
Because that's exactly where I'm going. So I would say that the my experience is that at the outset, there's sort of, it seems to me, there's like three phases. In the first phase of something like this, it's like, what did I say before? I said something to Karen on the phone. Anyway, it was a quote from Dogen anyway. But then there's a first phase where you really are enjoying yourself. Maybe for the first week or something, you know, you're dropping down, but you're not super deep yet, but you're dropping down and you're feeling, oh, I know what it was. You're feeling the vital path of total emancipation. Remember when I said that to you on the phone? Anyway, it's a quote from Dogen. And after the first week of practice, and we had a day off, and I was walking down the garden path down to the beach, I said to myself, the vital path of total emancipation, this path right here that I'm on. So there's kind of like that for the first while. And then it seems you seem to go down more into the slime. If that's where you go down deeper and it gets slimy. And then after that, we get to the sublime. But first it seems like we have to go to the slimy layer. So this is something I wrote about the slimy layer.
I was going to ask you, what is slimy?
Here it comes. and this, some of this reflects some of the teaching I heard. So, Dora Lee may hear some reminiscences of what she heard from in the Sesshin. The enclosure of egocentric consciousness, karmic consciousness, self-centered consciousness, all synonyms, is powerful, extremely powerful, almost disablingly powerful. Frighteningly powerful. The tendency to put the self in the center of every story, to project onto the other the self-centered, self-imagined stories. Also, the self-claiming, self-proclaiming face of karmic consciousness, always constantly thinking in terms of self, self, self. This is what you see as you enter intense practice. Self-centered, repetitive, self-claiming nature of karmic consciousness. Over and over this comes up and you see it and are shocked and you pull back and you wish for some release. Finally, release does come. Zazen mind gets strong enough. It slowly does gather strength. It eventually does become what the traps and snares of karmic consciousness can never reach. you do become somewhat unassailable. Mara's attack on the Buddha really makes sense in this context. Karmic consciousness, Mara, evidently feels threatened by Zazen's effort to subdue it, threatened by the efforts you make towards stillness and silence. You begin to feel more and more crazy, subject to even worse attacks, crazier fantasies, more ridiculous projections. Sesshin goes on, and finally Zazen mind becomes stronger. Zazen mind is like the Buddha, able to withstand the attacks of Mara, repel the attacks through his power of silence and stillness. Finally, after enduring so many withering attacks and bouts of craziness, finally it seems you are able to sit in peace. That peace itself has become even stronger than powerful Mara. Finally, Mara gives up, karmic consciousness gives up, and you can sit in peace. You can be in peace. So that's something I wrote. That's something I wrote when I came back. That was sort of an immediate impression piece. But it speaks for itself. I think this has been my experience every time that I've done this kind of practice, is that it just reveals just quite how self-centered I am. And I think this happens to everybody. You just see yourself, how you're just revolving around yourself. And there was a teaching, actually, that Rev said, that every sentient being is its own world. Is every sentient being, there is a teaching like this, and I actually read it someplace else too, that every sentient being is its own world. And the difficult spot we're in is that this world is so self-centered, self-reflecting, so ego-centered. And he had, Rev had this analogy of quoting D.H. Lawrence, who said, "I am an enclosure or a clearing. I am in a clearing in the midst of a dark forest." I am a clearing in the midst of a dark forest. But the clearing is named I, me, and mine. And so there's not much actual relief inside the clearing. And all around the dark forest are all around the clearing are these unconscious forces and this unexamined life of self-centeredness, essentially. Rev is my teacher is married to a Jungian analyst, so a lot of this comes in from that perspective, but it also comes in from the Yogacara teachings. I don't want to get too much into that, but because that's probably something for another night. But there was a lot of I don't think it took these teachings to have this kind of this kind of experience of just seeing my self-centeredness come up over and over again, and the projections and the stories that that are based on that self-centeredness, and you do really become sick of yourself. And Reb said, he said, one of the first classes, he said, "Well, I've been talking to a lot of people, and, well, you're all sick of yourselves." People are sick of themselves. And I think everybody was like, yeah, definitely. But it's not like thinking you're a bad person or anything like that. It's just seeing your stuff, how crazy you are, and how self-centered you are, and how you project all these fantasies in which, you know, you're the center. You're the center of the story. You know, the whole friggin' world is revolving around you. And when you see that clearly, you get really, it's just so shocking. It's so shocking and I don't know what to say. I mean, it's laughable in a way, but you do get really kind of disgusted with yourself and your mind and what's going on in there. And how you really see, like, what's shaping things for you in a way that you don't really see in daily life. But the good news is things get more sublime from there eventually. So here's some of my sublime writings. Let's see. Okay, I wrote this after one of Reb's lectures. A Buddha sits in the center of beings with eyes of compassion, with ears of compassion, seeing and hearing the cries of all beings. It's really essential to have both inward and outward focus. It's just the need to adopt more of that caring for others, for what others need and want. But really, it's not that either. It's enough to open the eyes of compassion, the ears of compassion. And I wrote this after, sort of everything becomes Dharma. I hate to say altered state, because that's really not right. But because it's not really an altered state. It's just that what you haven't been paying attention to, you're now letting come up. It's coming through, and some of it is really ridiculously egocentric karma, and some of it is the Buddha way, and it's all mixed up. In Zazen, it seems like it's mostly all junk, but after Zazen, it seems like it's all Dharma. It's all the Buddha way. I don't know how this. I mean, I don't think I have very many insights in Zazen itself, but I'm always having insights outside of the Zendo. So I was in this one book. I was reading the word. It was a Zen book, but all I read was this one word. Develop. And then it when I read that word develop, I had this image comes to mind. Zazen is like developing a picture from a negative. The picture is already there on the negative, but needs the bath of chemicals to be seen. Buddha nature, our deep awakened nature, is already here within us, but it needs the bath of samadhi, of calm introspection, in order to be seen clearly and to exert influence on self and others. Yeah. I just read the word develop, and it developed. Yeah, develop. Oh, yeah, that's how it is. It's just like a picture developing in a bath of chemicals. It's like, and what's becoming clear is Buddha nature, is our deep awakened nature. Oh, it's coming out. It's coming out from the background. It's in the background all the time, but we don't see it because we've got so much going on, so many mental formations, so much samskaras, right? Mental formations are hiding all of that. It's there in the background, but it's hidden all the time. But then samadhi is like the chemicals that bring it forth.
Sensation, perception.
Formations in consciousness. Yeah. The five skandhas. So then this was one. I was hiking up on the Middle Green Gulch Trail, and I was going up there to call Karen because you can't make a phone call from down in the valley because the cell phone doesn't get a signal down there. But if you hike up on the hills, your cell phone will get a signal. So I hiked up there, and it had rained that morning. And so it was still all socked in like low clouds and fog. And I was walking up, and pretty soon I walked right into the fog, right into the ceiling. And I, was just in the fog and I couldn't see anything. And then I was up there talking on the phone. And as I was talking on the phone, the ceiling started to lift. It was late in the day and the ceiling started to lift. And I, all of a sudden, whereas I hadn't been able to see anything, I could see the ocean. And I could see, what I saw was, I looked out towards Muir Beach and I could see these swells coming in. And it rained, so there was a kind of a storm type of swell, coming in from the north. And they were just marching in one after another. And I just thought that was, like the Dharma. I felt so encouraged by that. And so I wrote later when I went back down, I said, effort in Zazen could be like the swells lining up offshore. The swells just line up because that's what swells do. It's not a matter of developing or raising some special state of consciousness. Just appreciating with calm and peace. The swells are already lined up. The swells are already lined up. So this is basically, the view, that awakened nature is at the bottom of things. It's already lined up. It's always coming toward us. It's always coming our way. These swells were coming my way. But, again, only with the mind of samadhi, only with the mind of calm, can we appreciate and feel that those swells, that swell, not this swell of ego-centered consciousness, but that swell of awakened nature is the one that is truly us. And it's called ultimate reality for a reason. It's called ultimate reality for a reason. This egocentric consciousness, this karmic consciousness, is not reality. That's a mistake. That's delusion. That's a delusion. It looks so real and it's so frightening. Mara is really frightening. Delusion is and karmic consciousness. It's tremendously off-putting.
Is it an aberration?
It's an aberration. From the standpoint of ultimate reality, well, it's that is not real. The delusion isn't, and this is established Buddha Dharma. I'm not making this up, okay? Delusion is, according to established Buddha Dharma, is an illusion. It is a fiction. It is not real. This is established Buddha Dharma, that these hindrances that we face are and are subject to and cause so much suffering, those things are not real. That's established Buddha Dharma, and what is real is the ocean. The ocean of enlightenment. That's established Buddha Dharma. That's certainly Dogen Zen. Is that what is real is that the swells of awakening are coming our way, and our job, our work on the cushion is to open to that and to see ourselves as not separate from that. So I'm just not making like this is my enlightenment or something like this. This is the established Buddha Dharma. And Dogen talks about practice verification, right? Practice realization. So you have a body mind, and you have the opportunity to verify this. You can verify this teaching in your body mind, and it's, I would say, quite satisfying to do so. It's quite heartening to verify, to practice and verify these teachings in your own consciousness, in your own body. At the same time, delusive forces are quite strong, and they're probably going to be with us all our lives. As Suzuki Roshi said, the problems you have now are the problems you will always have. I don't think that's ever going to change. I've been practicing for over 40 years, and I can still go to this intensive and experience the full impact of my karmic consciousness in my craziness, in my egocentricity, in my self-claiming nature. But at the same time, I can be encouraged by allowing the sublime to come forth from deep within my life. So
the relationship to the problem has changed because it only took you 40 years to not be embarrassed about your mistakes.
That's right. And one of the things Rev actually said, and this is very interesting because there are some psychological theories that say today, modern psychological theories that say, for instance, that if you weren't loved as a child, you'll never function well in this world, and that you will always, essentially have problems, and your unconscious is forever damaged. And of course, anyway, what Reb was talking about was not that theory. Reb was talking about that conscious activity in the conscious realm, and I think this is basically his take on Yogacara teaching. It probably accords with Jungian views as well, but your work in the conscious realm can actually alter and change the unconscious, and it actually turns the Rubik's cube of your unconscious. Your work in the conscious realms actually changes the unconscious, and I think for me that's an example of, he brought up my thing about putting my robe on early in the Sunday lecture. I know, like, if that was some years ago, I would have just been mortified. But it was like, to me, it was just funny. It was just like, I'm fine to be an example to the world of what not to do, I didn't care, and I felt light about it. And for the most part, I did feel light about my mistakes. They didn't linger, and that is, I believe that probably that kind of thing is a change that's due to, this kind of work on the cushion. So one more, I think, from my I think I wrote this during Sesshin. Generally, you do not write during Sesshin, but I wrote this one thing. I broke the rule.
There's pockets where you have a pencil in the room?
No, it wasn't during Zazen. Oh. It was back in the room. Oh. I've never seen anybody do that. Yeah, that would be a subject of another lecture.
We'll go on there in his robe instead.
This one says, and this is probably, you know, came somewhat out of Reb's lecture, but it says here, embrace and sustain the mind that is embraced and sustained by all Buddhas. This is that mind. I don't know what I was trying to write there. Embrace and sustain the mind that is embraced and sustained by all the Buddhas. You could say it is a mind. Oh, I was supposed to say, what is that mind? Question mark. You could say it is the mind that is at ease, is calm, is joyful, is concentrated, is wide, a mind that doesn't try to control the self or other people. It is also a mind that doesn't get upset by or castigate minds that are not at ease, not calm, that are not concentrated, and that are not under control. It is at ease with those minds too. I'll have to remember that one. I wrote it, but I need to remember it. So, you know, the intensive is like climbing a mountain. It's very difficult. But the great thing is, you get up there, you can see for miles. And it's quite clarifying.
Your comment about writing during sessions made me think about a story. For the first session I ever sat was actually with Reb Anderson. I think it was like 1991 or 92 or something. Reb said something that was pretty funny at the time. He's like, well, he's talking about writing during session. He's like, in Japan, you know, they have Kensho experiences, so they let you have a piece of paper and write. But we don't do that here, so you don't need the paper. Thought it was funny.
Right.
I'm latching on to the self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it ever going away. I could sit zazen from here until eternity, and that self-centered, because that's where it all is. That's where.
It's not where it all is.
Well,
but that's where a very shocking amount of it is.
Yeah, what I mean by that's where it all is, that's where all the work is for me.
Yeah.
From that self-centeredness and from that what becomes the unconscious. And so does non-attachment ever become a fixture, or is it something that's always that always has to be brought back?
That's a great question. And usually you say it's a great question when you don't know the answer. You know, all I can say is that we're certainly committed in this place, in this room, and in this sangha, and I think all the sanghas here to the ideal of non-attachment. And to a certain extent, it will remain an ideal. But it's different for people who know about that ideal than people who don't know about that ideal. So does it ever, you know, I mean, there are saints, okay? There are, there have been living saints. There are today, I'm sure, living saints. But I think according to the tradition, You have to reach the status of an arhat, to completely be completely non-attached. And there are several lower rungs of the, you know, Buddha way that or stages, if you will, of development in practice. And I'm still somewhere in those lower rungs, so I don't know about reaching that complete freedom that you're talking about.
Yeah, in my personal life in the practice, because in San Quentin we have the Soto Zen practice, and so for years, over 10 years, I've been going to the Board of Parole hearings to submit an application by a process of a hearing to try to gain my freedom. And I pretty much was unable to say or do the right thing when I was in there. And then the final time, I said, well, I think I'm going to take the practice into the boardroom before the board actually begins. And I did that.
In what? How did you do it?
Well, I sat zazen just before the hearing, mm-hmm. about an hour.
Okay.
And in so doing, I went into the hearing, unbeknownst to me, in such a way that whatever I had been attached to, whatever I was fearing, guilt, shame, all of these things, it did not appear, or it did not resurface, and then I was able to show transparency,
mm-hmm.
and show honesty, and then also be able to talk about this unconscious, this selfishness, this greed, this ill will, this violence, all of these things. But it wasn't like that's who I am. So the non-attachment allowed me to be who I am and not this
Yeah, well, and here you are. Congratulations. It helped you, and had no doubt helped those members on the Board of Parole, you know, and they saw your sincerity, and they said, "I believe this guy. I believe he is not saying the words, but that he means the words, and he really is sincere in his statement, and therefore, they probably could find it in their hearts and minds to say, yes, you could have parole." Seems like that's what happened. It's great. And it's great we have such a system that finally, you know, lets people show their sincerity. And it was great we have people going into the prison to teach this way of sincerity and offer it to people there, and then, you know, people can move on with their lives eventually.
There is no doubt that Green Gulch is inside of San Quentin.
Yeah. That's great.
I didn't quite understand the image of the forest clearing with the dark forest around. I wasn't sure if you were saying that the dark forest was part of the self also,
mm-hmm.
Or if that was other.
It's not. I mean, I'm not really quite sure. I mean, this is him using a literary image to make a point about the conscious and the unconscious, but my understanding is that it's all the self. and it's in the one, and that the unconscious is part of the self. It's part of the world, but it's unacknowledged. It's unacknowledged. It's not integrated with the clearing, and the clearing is going on somewhat oblivious, thinking it can be somewhat oblivious to the dark forest, and if it's successful in being oblivious to the dark forest, then usually that's where bad things happen, because the unconscious processes are not acknowledged. Like I'm talking about in like sitting meditation, these unconscious processes being totally acknowledged, totally, you know, like the dark forest is so acknowledged, and it's unpleasant. It's very unpleasant to acknowledge it, but it is not shut out. It is seen as it is, and there's something in that seeing it as it is, and confronting it over and over again, and being sick of yourself over and over and over again, that these aspects of the self that you see, your selfishness, your egocentricity, your story making, your projections onto other people, and somehow, because of the strength of the Buddha way, the power of samadhi, at some point, you know, those attacks or what appear to be attacks don't register anymore, and there's some integration happening, I think, but I don't know that you can see it. I don't know that you can see it. I mean, I'm sure Dora Lee would have tons to say about this as a psychologist, or if there's other psychologists in the room, but probably she can give a talk on that sometime. You know, I'm not a trained psychologist, but I do know my experience. I do know we've delved a little bit in this group into the Yogacara teachings, and we probably should in the future delve more into this, into the storehouse consciousness and the way it relates to what I'm talking about, and I think there's a rich field of inquiry there that we could profitably look at some point.
And it might trump psychology.
What's that?
It might trump psychology.
I think it might be an interesting dialogue between. I think in Reb there's an interesting dialogue going on between Western view of the unconscious and this Buddhist view of the unconscious, and D.H. Lawrence's literary take on it, and I think there's an interesting dialogue going on, and if that dialogue happens, we're better for it. We're better for it.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, yeah, the unconscious and the conscious, I mean, traveling back and forth, talking, you know, communicating to each mm-hmm. other is usually helpful.
Right.
I mean, it's not just a one-way thing to bring it up, but also to have a conversation
right.
between the two.
And also just, you know, to have a conversation between what's in the foreground of our lives, which is thinking and feeling, and the background of our lives, which is Buddha's way, and the deep appreciation of how it's coming to aid us all the time. Barry?
I already asked. Does anyone else have a question first? Or?
I don't know. We probably need to end pretty quick. Maybe this will be the last one.
So I was thinking while you were talking, you know, now that I have family and kids and stuff, I don't really get a chance to go away to long retreats anymore, you know, at most maybe 5 days of shed or something. And it's, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that a lot happens at session that doesn't happen with normal kind of everyday practice. You know, I mean, I think your own experiences, you know, you had a, I think a much more, I don't want to say accelerated because I kind of, but you know, a deeper dive than maybe if you just hung out here, you know.
Yeah.
And it really makes you think, you know, well, people who can't get away to that, you know, logistically or maybe even financially, you know, I think there's, it's worth exploring another way to kind of try to bring that to the lay life. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, we had our 2.5 day sesshin here. And, you know, that was, I felt like a lot of people took a bit deeper dive when we did that. And I know they did. I mean, there was a deeper dive that happened. And so, you know, but you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. And in the sense that what I did, you know, and what I've done, been able to do in my life isn't, is, it seems like it's probably not accessible to everyone. And but you know, we have to, you know, I still think that if you hear about, even if you hear about, hopefully, you know, if I give a talk like that, it's not, the registration in you is not that, well, shoot, I never get to do that, so I'll never feel like that, and I'll never have that, you know, experience. The hopefully is like you would be encouraged by that, and you would, you know, it would help you take a little bit deeper dive just hearing about my experience. I mean, that's the point of me sitting up here talking, is to encourage your practice, and if it doesn't have that effect, I apologize. It shouldn't. You know, feel like, you know, that sort of somehow it puts you outside of something. I mean, that's not the point. And I don't mean to, I wouldn't ever want to be talking like this in the sense of saying there was some special experience that I can have, but you can't have, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely was not the point I was trying to make. But I mean, but it is a reality. Like, I think anyone who's done a multi-day retreat has experienced that. It's just a different thing, you know.
Right. Yeah.
All I want to say is that life has different seasons. Life has different seasons, and you have a different daily sesshin of dealing with small children, which will teach you all kinds of things that you had no desire to learn. And that the lessons that Jim has right now is just where his path is at this moment. And you have an incredible path right now, working with small kids and building their life. You know, one of my favorite stories about child development is that we are the ages of our children, and that our children are teaching us everything that we need to learn. And I can't, when I'm thinking about that journey, I can't imagine a harder journey than being a parent. And you are doing your sesshin every single day, every moment of the day, from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to bed. And if there's someone I would pray for right now, it would be you. Because you will be facing the darkest time ever as you go, how did I ever say that? And could I please redo that or do it differently? And, you know, that's, you know, and there's Jim on his mountaintop looking at the ocean. And that's just where he gets to be right now in his journey, in his life at this moment. And you have a really special time and place at this moment, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. statement, Carolyn, and you know what it made me think of is that the path is really about transmitting love, and it seems like I'm hoping to. That's what if I'm doing a little bit of that. If I'm transmitting a little love for the practice, then that's what I want to do. And if you're transmitting love for your kids, and your wife, and your people that you're working with in a daily basis, then I think. Oh, is that a hint?
It's not. I didn't mean to do it.
But I think it was a hint. Anyway, thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, Barry. Thank you, everyone.